Here's Mickey Mantle, powerhouse of the New York Yankees and winner of baseball's triple batting crown. Champions like Mickey play hard, and that takes real energy, plenty of extra pep and power. And Mickey knows that Karo syrup packs extra pep because Karo is so rich in important dextrose food energy. How about it, Mickey?
I've been eating Karo syrup ever since I was no higher than a baseball bat. Pour on plenty of Karo syrup, like I do. Nothing flavors a stack of cakes like delicious Karo. Really tastes great. Gives me energy, too. I love it.
Yes, Mickey Mantle really goes for Karo syrup. Karo's dextrose food energy helps you star on any team. And taste? Say, Karo syrup tastes best, flavors best, because it's richer, smoother syrup. Have some tomorrow morning. Karo, America's favorite table syrup.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Left My Wallet. I'm Antonio the Promised Thomas, also known as Thomas Santel, and I want to thank you for tuning in today for a little bit of a different show with a very good friend of mine, wrestling historian Tom Burke. And Tom and I go back probably a few years after I got into wrestling, probably about 2003. And Tom, for people on the site that know of Tom, know who he is, the people that he's mingled with and the magazines that he has written for, he's done it all in terms of stuff outside of the ring in this business, not booking or directly related to wrestling, but you throw out names like Steve Yohei or other historians, you know, a guy like Larry Matisic, who Tom knew very well. Tom was had a lot to do and still does with Cauliflower Alley. He wrote for Ring Magazine. He wrote for a lot of magazines. He took pictures for various magazines as well. And Tom has a virtual museum of memorabilia in his house. And I know Tom right here from the Springfield area. He was very good friends with Lou Thesz. He was very good friends with Killer Kowalski. Gave the eulogy at his funeral. He was that close with Walter. So for those who may not know Tom Burke, this is a guy that has an immense knowledge of professional wrestling history, and I wanted to talk with him and share it with you about some of the more popular football players, athletes that have crossed over into wrestling, some of the early pioneers of two sports stars like Bronco Nagurski, Gus Sonnenberg, Wayne Munn, and Tom is going to give his perspectives on that. He's also going to talk about his thoughts on some people who maybe aren't in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And this is a fun interview. I think you're going to enjoy it. I put it as a free show because I want everyone to listen to it, because Tom, he's just a fountain of knowledge. And for those that know him, you know how good of a talk this will be. I enjoyed it thoroughly. We did it in person at his pretty much museum in his office. And I'm going to post pictures also of some of the stuff that he has, memorabilia, on the board. But before we get to my talk with Tom, I got a couple important housekeeping things. First of all, many of you already know by now, I, as Thomas Santel, will be competing in Bloodsport on the Thursday of WrestleMania week. I'm super excited about that. Bloodsport, if there was anything that was made, I don't want to say it was made for me. I've never fought in martial arts, but, you know, I've done martial arts most of my adult life. Did a little amateur wrestling in high school, but it wasn't really till I got into wrestling that I started taking up martial arts. Mostly Muay Thai, boxing, a lot of no-gi grappling. And I incorporated that into my wrestling, which I enjoy doing and I love. And I'm very much looking forward to this. This is truly one of the biggest shows I think probably I've ever had. I'm just really looking forward to it. It's maybe the most talked about show of Mania Weekend just because it's so different. And I'm very much looking forward to it. I have another show that I will be doing down in Tampa that I will get to once it's announced. But that one should be fun as well. And it's going to be a little different. It'll be interesting, to say the least, when you see when it is. So not to give any hints, but it's going to be fun. It'll be fun to announce it. One more thing. I, as many or some of you know, am a health teacher and a phys ed teacher. I coach MMA fitness classes. I coach kids grappling classes. My whole life, my whole adult life, I have, you know, trained or coached, participated in athletics, whether it's wrestling or martial arts or, you know, other various other things. So health, fitness, nutrition has been my life. I have, you know, a number of certifications. I'm not going to bombard you with a bunch of letters or, AFA or this or that or certain things like that. But I also have finishing up a master's in nutrition as well. And I have an associate degree in personal training also. And I offer personal training here in the area, working with anybody really. I work with special needs kids during the day. But you know, I work with a boy that has muscular dystrophy. I work with a couple adults, just, you know, casual parents, you know, of some kids that I train at my MMA gym. You know, I have some high level kids that I train, very high level, actually. We have a 13-year-old girl that, just competed at the Mass Mutual Center in a grappling contest in front of 3,000 people. Adults, fellow colleagues of mine in wrestling, I have some experience in helping people with nutrition, with training. And if you are listening to this and are looking for some guidance in your nutrition, in your fitness, just your overall health and well-being, let me know. Email me at retrograppler23@gmail.com. And let's see if we can help you out. I'm starting to do online consultations and online training. Or if you live in the Springfield, Mass area, I can come to you directly and help you out. But I wanted to throw that out there because pretty much everything I do in my day-to-day career as a teacher, after that, when I go and train myself and train others, and in pro wrestling, this has been my life, fitness and nutrition, and I want to help you out. And if I can, please let me know at retrograppler23@gmail.com. You can also tweet me at Promise Thomas, or better yet, at RetroGrappler on Twitter for my Thomas Santel account. Okay, here is a very fun interview, not interview, just a talk, as we do here. We shoot the shit with a very important guy that has taught me so much about pro wrestling and its history, which is so, so important. Here is my conversation with wrestling historian Tom Burke. Enjoy.
Tom Koligoski, weighing 234, the champion of the United States, against Jim Landis, weighing 202, the champion of Europe for the undisputed championship of the world. The official announcer has just introduced the two boys.
I was reading an article on Slam Wrestling. It was about Billy Sandow. And this is, you know, this show mostly talks about sports.
Right.
And there was a paragraph in there talking about how he introduced Wayne Munn into wrestling, who was probably, and correct me if I'm wrong, you being the historian, was the first college football player
to enter into the pro ranks.
Right.
And he was probably, he was a name in the gridiron.
Because college football back then was bigger than pro football.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then, of course, he had that name, and, of course, they figured they're going to capitalize on the name and everything. But from what I understand from reading about him, the transition from the gridiron to the mat was not there and everything. He was not – I think he was a draw to a degree, but he didn't have the longevity to be a major draw.
Well, it said in the article, Stanislaw Sabisco kind of exposed him.
Exactly.
And that was it. He was done. Because yeah. it was, you know, that was ushering in the showmanship.
Showmanship,
era.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the business back in that era was extremely protective and everything, which, of course, continued on for decades. And it's watered down now to such an extent it's not protected at all.
No. Yeah. So being a sports show, you know, I want to touch on a little bit of everything,
yeah.
But being a sports show, I want to talk about the early infancy of bringing football players and athletes from other sports into pro wrestling. That article as well also brought in Joe Louis, Jack Dempsey, the history with boxers.
Yeah.
Crossing over into pro wrestling.
Yeah, let's talk about Joe Louis, because that's very interesting. Joe Louis, you know, was the world heavyweight boxing champion. Then he had dubious managers that really raped him of his income, and he eventually became a wrestler. Years later, and that would have been in the 50s, but even in the 70s, Sam Muchnick had put out a notice to wrestling promoters in the NWA asking them if they would book Louis as a special guest referee to help supplement his income, which he did. I remember he did a show in Madison Square Garden, and I can't remember who he wrestled, but he went around the country as a referee. And everything, so you know, out of respect and everything. And then, of course, he did a stint as a wrestler back in the 50s for a little while, but that never capitalized on as his boxing element and everything.
Who do you know who that was against, and how he transitioned kind of to the ring from boxing?
His first opponent publicly was Kobe Rocky Lee, and that would have been, I think. If I'm not mistaken, it might have been in Washington, D.C. and everything. But and then he toured. Matter of fact, I got a picture of Joe Louis at the Holyoke Valley Arena with the ring announcer Tom Mortimer when he made an appearance there as a referee, not as a wrestler. And everything. That would have been probably, again, mid-50s or so. Wow. And everything.
So he was... He was a big draw as a referee.
Yeah, as a referee, and just a name. Just a name. You know, he was definitely an icon to the boxing world, and not only in the boxing world, but in sports society in general and everything. So you have an individual there who was a living legend, really.
Yeah. And there's always been the crossover with boxing and with wrestling.
Exactly. Rocky Marciano was another one Jack Sharkey, they both refereed. And it's interesting that the boxing referees, the first promoter to use boxing referees was a guy by the name of Charlie Gordon, who was opposition to Paul Bowser in Boston. And he's the one that started bringing in boxers to to referee. He brought in Sharkey along with others, which is kind of interesting. And I'm trying to think.
No relation to Eddie Sharkey.
No, really, Eddie Sharkey. Braddock, the Cinderella.
Oh, Cinderella Man, James Braddock.
Yeah, yeah, James Braddock was another one who refereed as well and everything. But these were the guys that were, were brought in, and it gave some legitimacy to wrestling as well and everything. People looked at, well, they're bringing in so-and-so, you know, so it's not a jabroni to referee.
Was it back then in the 20s, 30s, was wrestling looked down upon as, hey, we know this has worked, but there's still that intrigue that was...
I think there was the intrigue, and also I think the press back in the... back before the expose in the 1930s, they respected the sport, especially in the 20s and everything. Matter of fact, I just did some research on wrestling here in Springfield, and there was a wrestling promoter back in the 1920s to the 1930s, and we're having Mr. Burke is having an issue with a name now. Oh God Almighty! Let's see.
Not Tony Santos, promoter from around
this,
here.
This was a legitimate wrestler. Oh. He was a shooter. He's the one who developed the double wrist lock when he was wrestling.
Which is the Kimura, better known as the Kimura double wrist lock. Yeah. Billy Robinson later kind of popularized.
Exactly,
yep.
Exactly. He ended up having matches at the Springfield Auditorium, which is now the Springfield Symphony Hall and everything. But I got pictures of them in the ring. I shouldn't say ring because it's not a ring. It's just a mat on stage. There were no ring ropes or ring posts. And this would have been 19... I'll show it to you before you go.
Sure.
Would have been 1920, I think it was, and everything. Just amazing stuff, you know. But... So again, here you have a situation where you have legitimacy coming into the sport, and it was treated as a legitimate sport at that time period.
Especially in St. Louis, because Sam Mushnick knew all the reporters. Joe Garagiola was doing the broadcasting there. That was the cream of the crop for. That was like their PWG back then, the best of the best.
As a matter of fact, it's interesting you mentioned Graziola. Graziola did the commentating for Mushnick and everything. And then he went later on to become a national broadcaster on the Today Show.
Right.
When
NBC Baseball Game of the Week with Vin Scully.
Yeah, and he also was the sportscaster for the Today Show. And when the rivalry took place per se with the WWF and the NWA, Lou Thesz was on the Today Show. Through Munster and Graziola.
Wow.
And because Graziola and Thesz were both St. Louis boys, they had a common bond. They knew everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I wish to God that I had that tape. I would love it and everything, you know? Yeah.
Well, that brings me to Lou Thesz. You have, and we'll get to how you. Your backstory and how you got into wrestling and whatnot, but you had a great relationship with Lou Thesz. Is that correct?
I did.
How did that come about?
Well, the first time I met Lou Thesz was at the IWA show in Jersey City, Roosevelt Stadium in 1975. And I was in the dressing room. I was with the Ring Magazine at the time, Ring Wrestling Magazine. And there's all these guys are huddling around Lou and all that. So as everybody parted and everything, they ran over to see somebody else. I walked up to him, introduced myself cordially, and I said, I have a message for you, sir. And he said, what's that? He said, I said, Bull Curry told me to say hello to you. Oh, you know Bull? And I said, yeah, I know Bull. I'm from Springfield, Mass. He's from Hartford, blah, blah, blah. That opened the door. You know, and we started talking about something, And I asked him if he had a specific program or something. He says, no. I said, I'll make a copy for you. And I did. And that started our friendship and correspondence and everything. It was, you know, and I'm very grateful for that. Absolutely. Mm. Because, you know, Fez to me was the Babe Ruth of wrestling.
Yeah.
He exuded class, kind of the personification of the NWA traveling champion, which Ric Flair then would later, you know, Ric Flair, Dory Funk, you think of a
Terry Funk,
Terry Funk,
Briscoes,
And he has been here. I mean, we're sitting here in your office, which is like a museum of wrestling memorabilia. But Luthez would come here, he'd visit. You have a lot of his memorabilia, including some signatures in your guest book.
I have my guest book signatures, but I also have letters from him, which are very dear and everything.
Which is a lost art nowadays, writing.
You got that right. Yeah, everybody just texts or tweets or thank you, President Trump. So anyway, but you know, it's just nuts. It's freaking nuts.
Yeah.
You know, but the art of letter writing is gone. I was just thinking about that today. I had just sent Diane Devine a note and everything, and I do her eBay for her, and I'm thinking, God, Diane, I've known each other for 50 years, and you know, and the correspondence that we had, and there's so many others that I'm still friends with that I used to write letters to, but now we communicate via Facebook or emails and everything. Tom Hanks is one of them, and Dean Silverstone.
Okay. You have corresponded with
Tom Hankins.
No, oh, Tom Hankins. I thought you said okay.
Yeah.
I'm like Jesus. I'm like
not the movie star.
All right,
Tom
Hanks.
Tom thinks he's a movie star, but he's not.
Tom Hankins.
Hankins. Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, yeah. I want to go back to the football players because the first major football player that really became a megastar was Gus Sonnenberg, correct?
Gus Sonnenberg. And then probably after Gus would have been Bronco Nagurski.
Okay. Now, yeah. Gus Sonnenberg, what made it different for him than Wayne Munn, where people didn't shoot on him, people, because he had the flying shoulder tackle, which incorporated.
And also, I think maybe just appearance-wise.
Okay.
You know? Sure. And then, of course, where he was promoted out of, too, out of Boston, out of Paul Bowser's office.
Okay.
And everything. I think that was a big influence, whereas Munn was probably from the Midwest, and I don't think he had the charisma and everything.
Sure.
I think his last name, Munn, was a nun.
Right.
It was no pun intended. It was very mundane.
Exactly. Fun, Tom. Yeah. But you had Gus Sonnenberg coming in, and then you also had, like I said, Bronco Nagurski came in and everything, and you know, and then of course in the modern days, decades later, you had Ernie Ladd come in, Bill Watts, Wahoo McDaniel, you know.
Bronco Nagurski, what was, everybody knows him as being an all-time great football player, kind of up there mythically, like with Jim Thorpe.
Yeah.
You hear about Jim Thorpe, you hear about Bronco Nagurski. Yeah. What was the extent of popularity and success that Nagurski had in pro wrestling? Give the listeners here a synopsis of Nagurski's career and kind of who he would be like today. Would he be like a Goldberg popularity wise? Would he have been, give us your opinions on Nagurski.
I think he was probably what the promoters were searching for was a national hero and everything that who could transform from the gridiron to wrestling, to the mat, but also had the credibility of doing that, whereas Munn did not. Nagurski had it, and also I think his appearance and everything, and you know, he ended up becoming the champion for a while, you know, and he also interacted probably with the press as well, because that's when the press was getting involved in wrestling and everything.
Who, you know, there's Alex Karras as well, who got Karras, into...
Right, yeah.
Dick the Bruiser, yep. Is there a athlete, doesn't have to be football, that is kind of underrated in the annals of history for the influence or impact that they had on professional wrestling or making the transition over? Maybe that people don't think about or people maybe don't know about that you feel, hey, this guy's underrated, this guy isn't talked about enough.
That's a very good question. I think there's several, but one person's, because I see his picture, one person that comes to my mind who was a very good amateur wrestler, but he also was a star in his field outside of wrestling, but ended up getting involved in wrestling. And even though it wasn't a sport per se, it was an art form of ballet, and that's Ricky Starr.
Oh, yeah.
And everything.
Yeah.
And he, you know, Lou Thesz told me, we were talking about that one, and of course, they're both St. Louis boys as well, but he said that Ricky Starr was a very, very good wrestler. He had a very good amateur background. And there's
he was a legit shooter. He was an absolute dichotomy of what you saw with the ballet.
Exactly, wow. Exactly. Okay. And what's interesting that there's a woman at Temple University. She's the professor of the dance and theatric department there. She's writing a biography on Ricky Starr as we speak.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
And I've been able to supply her with some of the wrestling paraphernalia.
That would be a great movie,
kind
of, because it's such a...
He's such an odd... You know, he had such a fantastic career as a wrestler. Then he got involved in movies. Then he married a woman in France whose family owned a winery, a big winery. And then he got involved in a cult, which, and their philosophy was forget your past, only think of the present. And he just disqualified himself from any association with wrestling or people in the past, which is sad.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of past, your past, how did you, many people know you, many people listening here on the site, you're one of the most popular historians that people know about. People that I talk to, I know it. I'm friends with Tom Burke. We live in the same area, whatnot. Everyone speaks very highly of you, rightfully so. How did you get started? You're obviously a lifelong wrestling fan, but what was the impetus for you getting started and becoming a part of the business?
Well, it was probably when I was in high school, and I was a wrestling fan then, and I still am. Because I think even every wrestling historian out there is still a fan. I don't care what, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, you have to be. Everybody is a fan of the sport. There's different levels and everything. But getting to your question, when in the 60s, there was a wrestling magazine called Ring Wrestling Magazine. And in the back of the magazine, they had a contributing columnist that would write articles about what was going on in their area, and they would be published. So when I was a junior in high school, I submitted an article, and Nat Lube, who was the editor of the magazine, thank you very much. Continue, you know. And well, one thing led to another, and I started getting involved in writing articles and did fan clubs, etc. And it just opened doors and everything. And like with Lou Thesz, I was a name dropper, you know. When I met a Bull Curry for the first time to talk to him, I told him that I said, Louis Golden says hello, who is an old-time professor, and Al Mercer, who are two old-time professional wrestlers that lived in the area here. Oh, you know them, and blah, 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 and that opened it up and everything. So, you know, certainly I didn't put either one of them in a headlock or anything, but that helped and everything. And, you know, and I think what it is, too, to be, and I don't want to pat myself on the back, but it's the sincerity I had about the sport and everything, and I think they saw that. and everything. And, you know, I was very fortunate, extremely fortunate.
And being you kind of you, I don't want to say you broke the fourth wall or whatever the saying is to get into the business. But, you know, obviously wrestling was very protective. It was like a secret society back then. But what allowed you to become such good friends with Killer Kowalski, where I started my training in 2001, but you became. We're going to get to the story later about his funeral, but because it's a great story that I want to finish with. But you would go, you were friends with him and very good friends with him, and you would go. Jeff Costa would show me the pictures of you reffing at the school and taking pictures. Yeah, yeah. What allowed you for Walter to allow you in and say, hey, someone who's not taking bumps, someone who's not training or isn't a shooter, come inside, be a part of our family.
Well,
and
I remember the exact first time that I met Walter to talk to, even though I had seen him wrestle here locally at the Springfield Auditorium back in, I was a kid, I was like 14 years old, I was 13 at the Springfield Auditorium and everything. But I didn't get a chance to speak to him till 1969, when I met him at a WFIA wrestling convention in Pittsburgh, and he attended and everything, and he was mixing with the fans, and I went up to him and I said, how did you like your tour of South Africa? And he looks at me, says, how do you know about that? I said, well, I have a correspondent in South Africa who sent me stuff. Really? But so that is what opened it up, and we started talking and everything, and you know, one thing led to another. That was in 69, because I had just got out of the Army. As a matter of fact, today's my anniversary date. Thank you, 51 years ago.
Oh, God, congratulations. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Yeah. And anyways, I ended up 3 years later in 72, I was in Burlington, Vermont, and Grand Prix Wrestling was running. And I
That's
had
from Montreal, correct?
I had the Montreal office, and God bless the Vachons. They are the ones that really opened the door for me, and everything. I was extremely fortunate. Anyways, I met Kowalski again. They permitted me in the dressing room. I did an interview with Killer Kowalski, and everything. We started talking, and one thing led to another, and everything. And then I went up the next month, and he said, "Well, I'm going to finish up here. I'm going to go to WWE. I'm going to go to the New York office." He said, "I said, well, who's going to manage you?" He said, "Oh no, I'm not. I don't need a manager. I do all my talking." I said, "But all the heels have managers, you know, to myself, you know." Huh? And anyway, he goes to WWF, and who gives him? He's with Ernie Roth, the Grand Wizard, as the manager and everything. And we bang into, and I met him at a show. Sometimes he said, "You are right. They did give me a manager," and you know, that just kind of opened everything up.
It's like this guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. So you know, that's how it started. You know, so I was very blessed, really. I love Walter to death. He's one of the finest gentlemen I've ever met in wrestling.
Yeah. I'm looking right here on your desk, right in front of us. I mentioned Steve Yoe off air, who, you know, good friends with Dave Meltzer and a fantastic historian. I have right here, if you can hear these pages rustling, he has the Jim Londos record book. There's two volumes here, and they're about the size of phone books.
Exactly. And you know, you got about 500 pages in each one of these things.
Yeah. How did you get a hold of this? I mean, you have, I'm going to put some pictures up on the message board here on the site of your office and some of this stuff. But how many are there in existence of this record book? And
he did a limited press run. I don't know how many. You know, he sold some. He's done a series of record books. The one I really wanted is no longer available, and that's on the French Angel, Maurice Tillet. But he's done those and a number of others and everything. But I mean, it's just phenomenal. I mean, and he did. But I don't. God, I don't know how he did this. He was doing this when he was still working. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's retired now and everything. But it's a a chore to get to do this. I mean, I'm trying to work on the New England history, the history of wrestling in our area here, and it's a chore.
Yeah,
Jim Barnes is the promoter's name.
Jim Barnes, there
it is. I knew it would come. It would come to me. Yeah.
Jim Londos, though, he was the first
megastar.
He was Hulk Hogan before.
He was the Hulk Hogan, the Ric Flair of his era.
Okay.
The Golden Greek and everything, and I think for a lot of things dealt with him. Was his ability within the ring, but also his persona. The press loved him and everything. And I'm telling you, when I'm saying wrestling, not only the wrestling press, but the non-wrestling press and everything. And he was promoted well and everything. And he ended up becoming an idol, you know. As a matter of fact, and legitimately, he was a hero. not only in wrestling, but outside of wrestling as well. He was after World War II, he developed a charity for orphans, Greek orphans. And years later, he was awarded a Congressional Medal of Honor.
Sure.
And the King of Greece gave him that honor for their own, whatever they call it over there. But, you know, it's just, he was a national hero.
Yeah.
Now, this was around the same time as Strangler Lewis.
Correct? Yeah. But, Strangler Lewis.
So they were rivals to one another.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Kind of like Rock and Austin, Hogan, Piper.
Exactly. Okay. You know, and he was he had that Mediterranean look. He was a good looking guy and everything, and that attracted the ladies to the cards too. You know, so I think that was an impulse for promoters to keep him on top and push him. As well.
So a lot of people ask, like, who is on your Mount Rushmore of wrestlers? This question gets asked a lot. Not to put you on the spot here, but it sounds like Londos would be one of the four on there.
Londos would be.
In your opinion, who would be the other three?
Luthes.
Yeah.
You know, I would have Londos, Luthes, probably Rocca. And everything because of the transition as a high flyer and everything. And then in more modern times, Billy Robinson.
Oh, okay. Different.
Yeah.
Different. Yeah. I like it. Usually there's a Hulk Hogan thrown in there or a Steve Austin. But that's and I'm sure a lot of historians or people that go back to that time could certainly agree with why each of those four would be on there.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
because each one has their own element. For the business, Rocca,
the athleticism, the acrobatics,
exactly, which was something totally new to the business and everything when he came in, and of course he was a TV era too, and everything, you know, and you know I often sometimes wonder how some of these guys from the 30s who had a look. That would, you know, would cringe people how they would get over on TV, you know, with a big cauliflower ears, probably a couple missing teeth or something, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, rough guys.
Right.
Yeah.
The Observer, Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. It's different from other Hall of Fames in that it's voted on. By historians, wrestlers, people in the industry. Very strict limits as 70% you need votes. And there's a lot, every year when the Observer classes come out, there's a lot of debate as to who should go in and who shouldn't go in. A couple guys that I want to bring up and I know that you're proponents of. The first one would be a guy you mentioned before, Wild Bull Curry. I know there are other people that champion for Bull Curry to be in the Hall of Fame. He's not in there as we speak, but what is your case for Bull Curry being in any wrestling Hall of Fame?
Well, one thing, longevity. He was first, it's a carny wrestler, transformed from a carny wrestler. and he started back in the late 20s, and he was active in wrestling right up to 1984, the year before he died, as a manager for Kowalski. But he had a stellar career in the Midwest, Canada, and of course here in New England. He also wrestled down south.
Detroit, too, Detroit, with the Sheik.
Yeah, Detroit. It was before Detroit. He was pushed. He had been wrestling on a carny circuit, and he started wrestling for Adam Weissmuller, who was a Detroit promoter, who was the uncle to Johnny Weissmuller.
Johnny Weissmuller, Tarzan.
Tarzan. So that's how Bull got involved into wrestling on a circuit and everything, rather than a carny and everything. And, you know, Paul Bosch told me that his territory was dying. It was at Morris Siegel's territory, and Bosch was working in the office. He said Houston was down. Bull Curry came into it and turned it around and everything. And,
That was a lot of brawling, a lot of blood.
He brought that in,
yeah,
and everything. And you know that's how it ended. Ended the downfall, and it spiked, and it continues to. That transition for decades. You know, so you know, and then of course, Bull's legacy here, and mixed matches and everything. What I call mixed boxing matches with Bull Montana. And of course, he had a couple of matches with Jack Dempsey.
Wow.
And
okay.
You know. And then of course, there's the legacy of his sons too, Flying Fred, and his grandsons, Freddie the Third, and then Nick Curry.
Yeah.
You know, and you know the so the element is still there, and I definitely feel that he should be part in the Hall of Fame. The Observer and other physical Hall of Fames that are existing,
sure,
around the country.
Another guy, Bull Curry, he was almost like a precursor to Bruiser Brody.
Exactly.
Correct? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another guy this year that just missed out on being inducted was Don Owen. And there's a lot of people that have conjecture thinking that, well, he was just in one territory and it wasn't a large scale promotion like St. Louis was or the WWF. What would you say about Don Owen? But would you put him up there with?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because he started in probably in the '30s or so, but he continued on promoting right to the very end. He was the last territorial promotion that was ran. Until he finally retired, and that would have been probably in the 80s at some point, you know. So you know, considering that all the promotions were dead, and he still had his own group and everything, you know, and the wealth of talent that came up from that territory that became national is just amazing.
Piper, Buddy Rose.
Yeah, exactly. He was very. Open to give guys a chance, you know. Oh, and from what I've been told by people, that he is he was a good payoff man, you know. And of course his he had a brother too. Elton Owens, you know. And then of course Dean Silverstone worked for him, and then of course Dean split off and started his own promotion, or Harry Elliott in Washington and everything. But all those guys, you know, that Pacific Northwest was an extremely interesting territory. And Mike Rogers, who used to do a bulletin called Ring Around the Map, Northwest Wrestling. And he did that. He just ended up a couple years ago. And he did that for, 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. One more guy that is not in the Observer Hall of Fame that a lot of people feel should be there, Sergeant Slaughter. And let me give you the reason against it. It's because of when he left WWF, went to the AWA, and was kind of in the dying days of the AWA. And he had about a 5 or 6 year period there where he was just on the independents and he was, you know, still in his prime, arguably, and where he could have been a big money draw for those kind of what people say are like a lost 5 or 6 years. I think Sergeant Slaughter should be in the Hall of Fame. But what do you say to people that, you know, well, he missed out on 5 or 6 of his prime money making years, main event years, that, you know, kind of make him excluded from the Hall of Fame at the moment?
Yeah. You know, when I think of Sergeant Slaughter, I think of his feuds with the Iron Sheik, for one thing. As for his
departure, Pat Patterson,
right. His departure from WWE at the time, or WWF at the time, and going to the AWA, maybe there's more to the story than the selectors know. And, you know, the world of kayfabe still exists to a degree. And, you know, maybe there's some other issues that we're unaware of and everything, why he left. Why, well, you know, if you're on top and then all of a sudden you're going to another territory that's on its hinges, why?
Yeah, I think it was the residuals from G.I. Joe and exactly. Stuff like
that. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, so there's probably, those are probably the valid reasons, too, you know, and everything. But he's I think he should have should be in the Hall of Fame. Absolutely. Okay. You know,
An interesting question that comes up is always, you know, every generation, it seems, will frown upon or have criticisms of the generations before. You know, you certainly have people today say, everybody does too much and whatnot. And then the generation before, you had people saying Flair and Steamboat did too much. I'm sure Strangler Lewis was saying, oh, goddamn, that Luthez hit the ropes. What the hell? You know, blah, 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 blah. What were, going back to the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, do you remember these criticisms? Were these criticisms always there that the previous generation?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. You know, there was always critics or maybe not critical in the sense. But it, I remember Tarzan Tyler took Louis Lawrence on the side and everything, and I was in the dressing room in Burlington, Vermont, and telling him where his mistakes were in a match that he saw and everything. So he was mentoring the guy, not outright criticizing him vocally and everything. But getting back to your point, I think every generation will look at the product that they may not be involved in at that time and find some flaws and try to say, well, you know, if I was me, I would have done this, you know, or blah, blah, blah. I think it's only natural, you know?
Yeah. So it existed. It was always there.
It was always there. It'll always be there.
Yeah.
Well, be there. You know. Yeah. You know. It's going to be a situation where you know. Let's bring back the midgets. You know. You know. Yeah.
Who from today do you enjoy watching? And it could be the past 10 years or so, but who, you know, a guy like Daniel Bryan comes to mind, where his work stretches. You know, it relates to any generation.
Well, I like. Cody Rhodes.
Yeah,
I think he's good. And there's a young guy and God, I'm getting another senior moment that's on AEW that's very good. I gotta
keep MJF.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. You know, and they should wear name tags for me and everything. But you know, and you know, several others. You know, going back a couple some years ago. Regal and everything.
When yeah, very good friends with Regal. He's been here. Yeah.
You know, and Finley is another one I liked, you know, because they bring a different mentality and a different style.
Is there any acrobatic guys or high flyers that today that, or in the last 15 years that people say, oh, they do too much, that, boy, I really like, and like Rocca would have loved this guy, or, you know, someone like Rocca, who maybe was frowned upon for not being a shooter or whatnot.
Yeah. Is there anyone? You know, in that sense, I it's hard for me to say because I really don't pay that much attention to the TV, so I really can't say that. I can say it only on the independent scene that I've seen locally here.
Yeah.
And that's as a high flyer, Nick Curry carrying on the tradition of his dad.
Sure.
And everything. Okay. Okay. You know, but you know, that's where I would have to settle in and everything, because I don't, what do we got, wrestling like four times a week on TV?
Almost every, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky if I watch 40 minutes of it all during the whole week.
Oh, that's good for most people. Yeah. I mean, that's, no, seriously, that's, for the whole week, yeah. Sometimes, I mean, there's a lot on, and there's a lot to digest, so.
Cool.
Last thing here, you've told this to me a number of times, and I love it, but the story at Killer Kowalski's funeral, you gave the eulogy.
The wake.
Yeah. I want to hear.
There were two. We did two eulogies. Okay. We did one at the funeral mass. Don Bravo did the one at the funeral mass, and I did a little one at the at the wake.
But your class reunion, was it your 50th?
A couple years later, I was at an event, and a guy comes up to me that I went to high school with. He says, "Hey, Burke, are you still doing that wrestling shit?" And I said to her, I said, "You know, Boots, let me tell you." I said, "I just did the, I was at the wake for Killer Kowalski. I did the eulogy there. Did you do the same thing for that baseball guy you like so much? What, Ted Williams?" and he told me to go F off. But you know, once you're an ass, you're always, you know.
In 1941, Ted Williams hit .406. Reaching a goal that others have chased for a half century. And the kid still swings pretty good.
We've reached a new goal at Nissen, too. A while back, we asked you to try two fine Nissen breads, Canadian White and Brown. And most folks did, Ted.
Most? Are you telling me, Bud, that some people haven't even tried our Canadians?
Yeah, but I spoke to them this morning.
Let's bet 1,000, folks. Try both Nissen Canadians.